afternoon. Everybody, please have a seat. Okay, our final case on the docket today is docket number 64986, Integrated Financial Associates versus Katie Holm. Mr. Wall, are you ready to go?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, would you please come on?
Thank you, Your Honor. Chief Justice and Associate Justices Mike Morrell, on behalf of the appellants, Integrated Financial Association, and the other appellants who are collectively the Highland Funds, they are the lenders. I have with me today Kennedy Barnes, who is the counsel, Texas attorney here at Pearl Harbor Beach, and Patty Lee, who is also counsel on this case, and in the audience, some of the principals of my clients. I would like to reserve, if possible, 3 minutes for rebuttal. We'll see how that goes.
Certainly.
This case, there are two keys to this case, as I see. The first one is that it's on summary judgment, and the standard is high, and it hasn't been met. The second one that is most important is that the district court did not find that there was not evidence of fraud and inducement. The district court found that the evidence of fraud and inducement could not be presented because of the parole evidence rule. If you look at the record in this case, there is a tremendous amount of evidence of the fraud. But first I'd like to jump directly to the parole evidence rule because that's what the district court based its decision on. The parole evidence rule number one, the purpose of the parole evidence rule is so that evidence will not come in that contradicts the express terms of the contract. That parole evidence rule doesn't apply in the absence of probity. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that, but it should be pretty obvious in this case that the lenders in this case have no probity with KB Homes. They didn't sign the same contracts, they're not bound by that, and therefore the parole evidence rule shouldn't apply at all. Moving from that one to the issue of whether or not the purpose of the parole evidence rule, which is to keep out that evidence that contradicts the terms of the contract, that purpose isn't met in this case because the lenders in this case, they do not have any, the arguments do not contradict the contracts in this case. That was not the point of their arguments. Specifically, the only, respondent argues that there's contradiction of the specific terms of the contract, but only in two areas. Number one, 2.3 of the development agreement, and number two, the integration clauses themselves. The district court relied most importantly on the integration clauses themselves as the reason for not having parole evidence coming in this case. This point has held that the parole evidence rule does not apply. In fact, in 2013, Congress's Backish, this court specifically held that the parole evidence rule generally involves extrinsic evidence regarding prior contemporaneous agreements that are contrary to the terms of the agreement. Extrinsic evidence, however, is admissible to prove fraud in the inducement of an agreement. The only thing that we heard from the other side when we cited this case to this court was that, well, that case had to do with a contract that was lost. But that has nothing to do with the statement from the case, because the statement from the case gave three distinct exceptions to the parole evidence rule, one of which was to prove the existence in terms of a written agreement that has been lost or destroyed. One of the other ones was it doesn't apply in the case of fraud and inducement. There's good reason for it not to apply in the case of fraud and inducement. If you can't bring in the evidence to prove that the agreement itself was a fraud, then because you have a clause that says everything is integrated, then all you do is put in an integration clause in every contract and you deal with the concept of fraud and inducement.
Mr. Wall, let me ask you this. Let's say we agree with you on that point. I don't know if we will or not. That's why we're here today to have this argument. But if we did, what are the genuine issues of material fact that you would be presenting to the court at this stage? Where are we at? I just want to know how much difference it's going to make on this parole evidence issue.
In a nutshell, the genuine issues of material fact are that KB Homes lied to to my clients in order to induce them to enter into a contract where they make money, a lot of money, $60-something million, so that the project would go forward. They claim they didn't lie. They claim they did lie. In a nutshell, that's what the case is about.
And the lies are what? I don't want you to spend all your argument time, but tell me, I get it. If we were district judges and you were trying to convince us as genuine issues of material fact, give us in a nutshell what you would say.
I would say, in a nutshell, that first you have to understand that the first agreement failed because of lack of financing. And the reason that it failed for lack of financing was because there were not assurances that the infrastructure would ever go in. So the biggest issue in the second one was there has to be assurances of the infrastructure will go in. And so, in fact, in the contract, besides the one paragraph 2.3 that they want you to rely on, there are other things in there assuring my clients that if Focus, the general manager, doesn't put the infrastructure in, KB Homes will come in and put that infrastructure in. That's what they wanted. That, what triggered that? The trigger for that was the integration, What triggered that was the schedule, the development schedule that had to be approved. And the budget, but it was triggered and it was explained to them, and it's in the contracts. It was triggered by the adoption of a major infrastructure schedule. Not by
was
the
that, was that ever the, adopted?
It
or
was
is it just a proposed document?
The two different documents, and they were both adopted as we were told. That's what the issue is. We were told they were adopted, and then they were adopted. But what happened was,
you keep using this word, we were told in the record what was offered as to that particular point, because there seems to be the major bone of contention as to those two, the budget, the infrastructure, whether or not these were working documents or whether they were final documents.
Mr. Tripp and Mr. Diffie, the representative of KB Homes, told representatives of Essex, the purchaser, and of IFA, the lender, and of the other lenders, specifically, they were the ones who were told. They were informed that when this schedule was approved, KB Home would have several rights. They knew that was the linchpin of the agreement. They went to the meeting.
I keep coming back because I know we've been conflated into self-help rights and all, but still, these two documents, the importance of them, do we have something that was offered other than what I understand to be preliminary documents? I guess that's really the crux of what I'm interested in.
Because it's a fraud and inducement case, what we have that is offered is the testimony. And every one of the principals has testified to these facts in their depositions.
Could I ask a more specific question? Did you all offer any evidence or affidavits that contradict September 19, 2007, Diffie response found at 11 AA 1812, or anything that responded to an email entitled Inspirata Schedule, dated October 17, 2007, found at 11 AA 1808?
Those documents the answer to that is not directly, but the testimony did contradict those, because those documents didn't contradict the fraud.
As an example, can you name the deponent and what the testimony was?
The deponents testified regarding all of
these two specific issues.
On those two specific issues, those documents didn't contradict the fraud. So there was no reason to respond to those specifically because they were inconsistent with the fraud. So we didn't have those documents would not have given my clients any notice that what they had been told, which I was trying to get to, was not true.
Well, let's take, for example, October 17, 2007, Diffley's email to Holman, and I can't pronounce, is it Brynjolfsson, where he says, quote, "Here is the latest. This information is still subject to change," close quote. 10 AA 1784 of the record.
That was before the meeting. That was before the schedule had been approved on October 8th. After that, that's when they had the meeting where they supposedly approved the schedule.
This is dated October 17th, this email. October 17th.
And then, that's correct. On October 8th, they had the meeting where they specifically decided not to trigger the self-help. But Mr. Tripp, when he was speaking to my clients, he knew that they were under the impression that they had been told by KB Holmes that if the schedule was approved, the self-help rights were triggered. He told them, it's been approved. That was the first thing that he told them. He knew that was false when he said it. And the second thing he told them is, KB will finish the job. He told them those two things, knowing they didn't have self-help rights, and those emails afterwards did not in any way tell my clients that the self-help rights didn't exist. They didn't contradict the fraud. And that's why we don't have anything to say that those emails...
So I have a request, Mr. Wall. When we're concluded here, would you give the record cites for that testimony to the clerk, please? What you just described in the testimony that you just described.
The testimony that I've just followed, I can do that.
Thank you.
The point of everything is that the fraud, we could not have found it based on anything else that came to us, checking on the things or looking at things could have fixed this fraud. KB Holmes said, we will finish the project, and they said, the schedule has been approved. The schedule had been approved, but the self-help rights had not been activated, and they knew it. And they knew that without those having been triggered.
What schedule precisely? Was it indicated as a major infrastructure schedule that needed to be complied with, and that was that how it was referred to?
Yes, it's the construction schedule for the implementation of the major infrastructure.
Can I understand that there were budgets relating to that, and draft budgets were exchanged, but as far as I know, that's all that was done, those draft budgets. Did that trigger self-help?
Budgets are never completed, so the fact that this says draft budget doesn't really mean anything. It wouldn't have put my clients on notice of anything, because all budgets are draft. The distinction isn't that it could be changed, but the distinction is that it was approved. And when it was approved, and when the schedule was approved, there should have been self-help rights, and they weren't.
Excuse me. Approved by whom?
Approved by the consortium, which is the Board of Builders. And the consortium had their meeting, KB being the major, all the 38.45% of that. They approved the schedule and the budget, and he told us, we have approved the schedule and the budget, to convey the lie. And the lie was that we have self-help rights. And then getting to the contract issues, I didn't need to get into, but those issues are still pending, and that's the reason why all the rest of those arguments don't matter. They go to the contract and not to the fraud. This case is about the fraud. Had there not been a fraud, my clients would not have invested. It was absolutely clear from the beginning they would not invest without assurances that the infrastructure would go in. KB Holmes was completely in charge of that, and 3 months later, KB Holmes orchestrated the infrastructure not going in. After having promised my clients, they would make sure the infrastructure went in. I'll save my last 2 minutes if possible.
Sure. Thank you. Mr. Bice.
Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court, good afternoon. Todd Bice on behalf of KB Holmes of Nevada. Excuse me. Members of the court, the version of events and much of the arguments that you heard do not square anywhere with the record. And there's a lot of generalities that are spoken by the appellants, and I would submit that that's not an accident. Because, in fact, what the district court did here, and the district court had a comprehensive record in front of it, and it correctly under summary judgment, because even accepting the evidence, the actual evidence, not some of the rhetoric, but the actual evidence in light of the most favorable to the plaintiffs at the trial court below, would not have permitted any reasonable finder of fact to conclude that the elements of fraud had been satisfied by clear and convincing evidence. Now, I understand that on appeal and at the trial court on summary judgment, it's not the district court's role to weigh evidence. The district court didn't do that. But the quantum of proof that is required for fraud is still nonetheless germane to summary judgment because it is the quantum of proof that one is required to present in order to demonstrate that there is a material issue of fact, such that a finder of fact could accept the version. What has happened here has happened in this valley on many occasions after the Great Recession, is that before the Great Recession hit, Mr. Holman took a gamble. And it was a big gamble, and he acknowledged that during the discovery process. And his lenders backed him. And he was either going to be made the smartest person in the room if this gamble paid off, or the dumbest person in the room, by his own admission, if it didn't pay off. And unfortunately, for a lot of people, when the recession hit at the end of 08 and into 09, the property values nosedived. Mr. Holman, even though he had given a personal guarantee, the lenders knew that personal guarantee was worthless. He was completely overextended. And so what has happened is we now have lenders who are not, by their own admission, are not in perfectly with KB Home. They have no contractual relationship with KB Home. But they're now their story as well. We need to look for somebody to stick with our decision to loan this gentleman money in an environment in which property values were vastly rapidly declining and who had no ability to back up his personal guarantee. So now we're going to look to the sellers of the property. Let me deal with these issues on fraud, sort of in reverse order, because I think one of them is so obviously dispositive, and it ties into what you just heard, and how the evidence doesn't square with that rhetoric. Fraud, as the court knows well, and as this court has articulated over and over, requires a known statement of a false statement of fact, a knowingly false statement of fact, that in fact reasonably induced the party to rely to their detriment. Reliance is always a big issue in a fraud case, and as the district court recognized in the summary judgment order here, it's also dispositive of this one. Because even if you take everything that they said in the discovery process as true, there could be no reasonable reliance here. And that, even accepting the statements as they characterize them, and I'll get to that momentarily, as true, there could be no reasonable reliance. First of all, the purchase agreement in and of itself in section 5.2 and 5.3 specifically recites, these are not this general integration clause that counsel is referencing. These are specific recitals as the district court covered these provisions and said, there are no oral representations. We are relying only on our own due diligence. That is what they said, and it's specifically called out in the purchase agreement. On top of that, we then have the provision 2.4 in the Declaration of Development Conveyance and Restriction. And that right there is why the story you just heard about the schedule falls apart. You heard a story, supposedly, Mr. Tripp, despite the actual written term of all the agreements, the purchase agreement, the development agreement, supposedly represented on October the 16th, on a schedule dated October 8th, that somehow, supposedly, the schedule had been approved, and the budget had been approved, and KB is going to build this infrastructure whether the general manager does it or not. Now, that's an interesting story, because, in fact, as Mr. Holman admitted during the discovery process, he had, in fact, bargained for that very commitment by KB Homes, and it was rejected. He, in fact, in the purchase agreement, had asked for KB to give a guarantee that the infrastructure would be built, that it would build a guarantee if, in fact, the general manager didn't. No. KB said no. So what they actually agreed to is in section 2.3 in the development agreement, which specifically says that obligates KB to only use commercially reasonable efforts to pursue that end.
no commitment and no guarantee. And this is where this budget issue and this is where the scheduling issue comes up. No one disputes that, in fact, I believe it was on October 16th at the meeting, that the schedule, there was a tentative schedule, a conceptual schedule approved. And Mr. Diffley said that, and Mr. Diffley forwarded that on to the purchasers here, because the purchasers wanted to see that. They also asked for a budget thereafter, saying it's critical. Actually, the words were dire need. We are in dire need of seeing a budget. Well, they were shown a budget, it was a draft, it was conceptual, it was a work in progress, and they knew that. Now, what you heard from Mr. Ball is an argument, he says. Well, what Mr. Tripp really meant then is that he meant that Hubie Holmes' self-help rights had been triggered, and that's what we relied upon. That assertion has no support anywhere in the record, and he won't cite it to you. And you know why he won't be able to cite it to you? It's because if you actually look at the document entitled Development and Conveyance and Restrictions, which is at Appendix 1695, one of the documents they produced, it specifically talks about what the schedule has to look like in order to trigger our development rights. That provision provides, an express provision, it says that, in fact, it must be titled Major Infrastructure Schedule, it must specifically make reference to Section 2.4, and it must specifically recite that the builder, KB, is entitled to rely upon that document in order to enforce that against the developer, which was Southridge, i.e. Phillips. Then, of course, there was no one had issued that type of a schedule. The schedule was in the mandate done, and the version that was sent to them, they knew it for a fact. They obtained this document during their due diligence. They knew what was required in order to trigger self-help rights. And in nowhere are they going to be able to cite to you that they, in fact, ever saw a schedule, or that anyone ever represented that a schedule existed that satisfied the requirements of Section 2.4. And we can all understand why that schedule never came into existence. Because there was never even a budget. No developer, South Edge, was going to issue that schedule, was triggered with self-help rights of other members of the consortium, such as KB Home, without having a budget in place. And everyone agreed. Even the appellants here agreed. The budget was conceptual and in draft. In fact, they knew it was subject to change. So on the face of the documents themselves, the development agreement, the loan agreements, the loan agreement, which, by the way, specifically incorporates and makes the development agreement a part of it, specifically recites the fact that our self-help rights are only triggered upon the issuance of that particular schedule reciting all of those provisions. So no one, as the district court could say, no reasonable person could say, especially a sophisticated developer lawyer like Mr. Holmes, could say we reasonably rely upon this draft conceptual schedule and draft conceptual budget in concluding that their self-help rights have been somehow triggered. Failure number one of the fraud claim, lack of reasonable reliance. Failure number two of the fraud claim. Think about what they're claiming the supposed fraud is. The fraud is that our self-help rights were supposedly triggered, but of course their self-help rights are forward-looking. Remember what the contract, the development agreement actually provides, is that we would use our commercially reasonable efforts to see that the general manager puts in the infrastructure, including potentially exercising the self-help rights that we had. That is a statement that looks well into the future, depending upon, what is economically reasonable at the time. That's not a statement of present fact that was false and which they relied to their detriment. That's a statement that looks well off into the future, and none of us knew. Because if we did know, we'd all be a lot wealthier if we could have projected the complete collapse of the real estate market, particularly the residential real estate market.
You know, they made an argument that KB made misrepresentation by omission, by coming forward and indicating that the schedule was provided, triggered their self-help rights.
And Justice Gregory, I don't mean to be flippant about this, but it seems to me that's the equivalent of someone saying, well, you didn't tell me that the sun rises in the east and sets in the west. These were sophisticated developers who said they were doing their own due diligence, and in the purchase agreement specifically recited the fact that they were relying upon their own due diligence, and they had the documents. So to come in and say, well, you have this schedule, and you have this budget, both of which are acknowledged, are preliminary and conceptual, and to somehow conclude, even notwithstanding the terms of the declarant development covenants, that's expressly stated, here's what all has to happen before your self-help rights for KB Homes could ever be triggered. You have to have a particular schedule, it has to be entitled this, it has to recite the fact that this schedule is being issued pursuant to Section 2.4, and it has to expressly recite the fact that the builder is entitled to rely upon it. Their argument to you is, well, notwithstanding the fact that no such schedule ever existed, we never saw it, and we never asked for one that complied with the Section 2.4, we just magically assumed that that conceptual schedule, with a draft budget, which we admit was subject to change, was somehow putting off the trigger self-help rights. That, again, Justice Perry, simply does not square with what the actual documents provide. They cannot claim that they reasonably relied upon any purported representation. And again, I would emphasize, that representation is nonetheless a forward-looking statement, because it's about future events, that what we would or would not do in the future. I would submit it should be another fatal flaw in any fraud claim. And yes, Mr. Speaker.
My apologies.
Let me deal with this issue about the parole evidence rule and what the argument here is. Well, we're not privy, so therefore the parole evidence rule ought not apply to us being the lenders. Well, isn't that ironic? They don't have a contract with KB Home. They've asked KB Home to make no representations or warranties to them. They entered into no binding relationship whatsoever by their own admission. But they should be entitled to sue KB Home for allegedly breaching a contract with somebody who they lend money to. That's what this really comes down to. Their entire story on that contradicts the development agreement. And that development agreement, they made the decision, being the lenders, to incorporate that by its express and explicit terms in the loan documents. It's Exhibit J, in a loan agreement that they signed, that they issued to Essex, and it specifically recites that that development agreement, the only document whereby our limited obligations about this infrastructure are contained, are made a whole and in part and incorporated into their loan document. So they took that loan document as part of their own transaction. And so as the Ninth Circuit said, and I believe it was the Clark versus U.S. decision, the Ninth Circuit said, a party who is claiming rights that derive from the document cannot claim that, well, I'm a stranger to it, so therefore the parole evidence rule doesn't apply to me. So as to I can allege something outside of the document. If you are claiming rights that derive from the existence of the document, which is what they are arguing, because that's their theory is that we have the obligation to build infrastructure, then you are subject to the parole evidence rule, notwithstanding your claims of being a stranger and not having signed the development agreement itself. That was the extent of my presentation for your honors today. If the court has any questions for me, I'd be happy to answer them. If not, thank you.
All right, colleagues?
Nothing?
Okay, thank you, Mr. Weiss.
Some of the comments that were made by counsel would make sense if this were a breach of contract action, but it's not a breach of contract action. It's a fraud action. So the privity arguments about who we're trying to sue have nothing to do with it. Our clients were directly defrauded by their clients. That's what's going on here. The first key to this case is summary judgment. Almost everything that was said by Mr. Weiss up here went to factual disputes between the parties. He cited testimony from his clients, representations that they made that have been contradicted in the evidence. He said we couldn't have reasonable reliance would be a fact. factual issue that should go to the jury. We did reasonably rely on this, and the evidence of that is that we required it before you. We got assurances of it in the contract, and then it didn't happen, and these representations were given to us for the purpose of assuring us that the self-help rights existed. He quoted multiple documents and multiple pieces of information that came from a private meeting that we were not allowed to attend. Then Mr. Tripp misrepresented what happened at that private meeting. He said the schedule had been approved. The schedule we were provided never said it was exact. The budget has nothing to do with the self-help rights. The self-help rights were triggered by the schedule. That schedule was given to us, we were told that it was final, and we were told, this is a go. If Focus doesn't put in the infrastructure, we will. Our principals testified to that in deposition. That's a factual dispute. They say that didn't happen. That's really all I have, because my time is up.
So I should mention that you'll notice Justice Sada is not here with us today. She couldn't be here. She's actually watching the webcast, and she will participate in the deliberations in this matter. Counsel, thank you for the briefs and the arguments. We appreciate it. This matter will stand.